Okay, I think we can start if you're ready, Bill. And well, what can I say? Just two words to introduce you, Professor Phil Rosen. You perfectly know his name and his works, and he's one of the most important scholars in the field of film theory. And I think that everyone here read books like Change Mummified or Narrative Apparatus and Ideology. And I'm really grateful to Professor Rosen for accepting my invitation today and give us the chance to listen to him and to debate with him his recent work. And differently from many of the other academic stars, Phil Rosen is also a very gentle, sweet, beautiful person. So thank you very much, Phil, and you are welcome. And please, you can start whenever you want.
Thank you. Thank you, Giacomo, and thank you for the invitation. And and the very wonderful introduction of gentle and sweet. My topic today is not gentle and sweet, but thank you very much for that. And I very much appreciate being here in Bologna. And thank you for coming in this lovely room. I know it's not the best room for a seminar, but it's a real experience for an American to be speaking in a room like this. It's really, really wonderful. And in today's talk, I will divide my talk on punctual violence and cinema into, if there's a problem with my voice, with hearing me, just let me know. You don't have to raise your hand, just say something. In this size group, we can do that. So I'm going to mostly read a paper I've been working on for a couple of years, trying to get my head around a concept that's pretty much my concept, punctual violence. And I'm dividing it into three sections, and the first section is simply a kind of theoretical introduction, which I'm going to begin now. In my talk today, part of what I'm doing is broaching the concept of the state in relation to cinema, not just to the history of cinema, but also in relation to conceptualizations of cinematic representation and discourse. That is, I want to begin thinking about awareness of the state in filmic constructions, both explicitly and more implicitly, or to use a slightly old-fashioned term, symptomatically. I will do so with a focus on cinematic representations of violence associated with the state, particularly war. In this talk, I assume that anti-state violence, that is, violence in opposition to the state, is simply the obverse of state violence insofar as it is aimed at replacing one state configuration with another state configuration. And I should make clear that by violence I mean something literal and physical, as I don't mean metaphorical extensions. I mean acts intended to damage human bodies. In this regard, however, I will also keep in mind a suspicion expressed in a different context by Frederick Jameson. He asserts that, when raised in a political argument, violence is always an ideological category, which means it is not reliable as a historical concept. And when violence is invoked in a theoretical argument, he says, it too easily gravitates towards a metaphysics involving death, biology, and nature rather than history. It remains to be seen what might be the ideological import of representations and appeals to violence outside of theory, for example, in cinema. The particular strands of filmmaking that I will be invoking later as examples will be posed as a matter of temporality. In that regard, I will today focus on what I'm calling punctual violence in cinema, To explicate what I mean by punctual, I will begin with Paul Ricoeur's breakdown of three fundamental levels of human relations to time. He derives these from the history of philosophy. The first level is experiential, phenomenological, or personally lived time. The second level is its opposite. It is the impersonal, inhumanly cosmological time of the universe. The third level is the calendrical, from the term calendar, the calendrical. The calendrical serves as a mediator or connector between two other apprehensions of time. In calendrical time, which includes clock time, both personal time and cosmological time become humanly measurable because they are segmented and enumerated according to seconds, minutes, days, years, millennia, and so forth. In this calendrical temporality, occurrences may become events delimitable in a historical narrative. So historicity exists in the interplay of continuity and flow on the one hand, and disjunction and segmentation enabled by the enumeration of calendrical measurements on the other hand. Calendrical time is neither purely subjective as with lived phenomenological time, nor absolutely impersonal as with the cosmological time of the universe. Calendrical time then makes temporality not only countable, but a humanly collective thing. We can talk about it in common, and therefore it is public and narratable. Thus, Ricoeur does note that the calendrical level has political aspects, but he does not much elaborate on them. Now, the punctual. The instantaneous without before and after is difficult in this theory of time, for which narrative is so important. It is true that an instant can become a phenomenological present, existentially experienced as such by a subject. But this means it is always part of the perpetual subjective flow, the unending subjective successions of past, present, futures described in phenomenological philosophy's account of time. On the other hand, at the impersonal cosmological level, the instant can be isolated only by the segmentation afforded by the calendar. Within calendrical time, then, the instantaneous can be marked as event by being given a precisely numbered date and time. However, this is immediately caught in the following paradox. Once marked as such, the absolute separation of the instant collapses because it has been positioned within a directional time continuum, a succession of dates and times. Therefore, it remains within the realm of before and after, which enables historical narratability and connection. In some sense, then, the punctual seems impossible to grasp. What follows in my paper today is marked by this notion of the punctual and its impossibility as in itself. My title, Punctual Violence, yokes the impossibility of the absolute temporal instant with another seeming impossibility, a representation of violence that would do justice to violence. This comes as an offshoot of work I've been trying to do on state violence in cinema. In my view, both the history of cinema and filmic textuality have been heavily marked by state violence. On the one hand, I believe that the history of both national and global cinematic institutions and their political economies have always been tied into the contemporaneous history of wars among states. But furthermore, all of film history is pervaded by representations of state violence and representations of agencies of state law and state violence, not just as documentation, but in the history of fiction films. Perhaps when so many narrative films throughout film history have included elements representing iconic agents of the state, especially the police and the military, we may look there for cinematic figurations of state power through representations of state regimes and institutions and imaginaries of their effects. This is related to my focus today on force or violence as effects of state power as a question for cinematic representation. So that's the theoretical introduction. And now I proceed to the second part, which has the title, Can There Be Punctual Violence in Film? Why raise the notion of punctual violence in films? One reason is that it seems to lead to a kind of representational desire one might call political, or in terms that have currently gained more theoretical favor, ethical. This desire is for some degree of adequacy or sufficiency in the representation of violence, though what adequation might mean in such a sentence is hazy. I name this the desire to do justice to violence. As with many desires, the whole notion of adequate representation of violence may be a constantly receding mirage. But one constantly encounters a general sense that the adequate representation of violence in cinema would be a good thing, and that it would require some radicality of filmic discourse to achieve. This is not a new desire. An example of an articulation of the issue for narrative film is in the American World War II novel, The Thin Red Line, by James Jones. When published in 1962, it was praised for its depiction and exploration of the experience of war. In 1998, Terrence Malick adapted this book, as we all know, making a film that could claim to be cinema d'auteur and yet could claim to also capture the tensions and experiences of war. I'm not really interested in an adaptation study here, but I think a few comparisons will be helpful. Much of the novel is composed of interior monologues of numerous characters, all infantrymen, in a fictional Company C during the American invasion of a fictionalized Guadalcanal. Thus, after an extended account of a small failed attack in the middle of a battle, one particularly articulate enlisted man, a former officer, John Bell, is now undercover, taking shelter, with another soldier named Witt, and he generates such an interior monologue. And I will now quote at length, but just a little bit of this monologue, which goes on, it's extremely interesting. So this is from the novel. Bell was thinking that Witt had come through it all right, like himself. What power was it which decided one man should be hit, be killed, instead of another man? So Captain Buggerstein's little feeling attack was over. If this were a movie, this would be the end of the show and something would be decided. In a movie or a novel, they would dramatize and build to the climax of the attack. When the attack came in the film or novel, it would be satisfying. It would decide something. It would have a semblance of meaning and a semblance of an emotion. And immediately after, it would all be over. The audience could go home and think about the semblance of the meaning and feel the semblance of the emotion. Even if the hero got killed, it would still make sense. Art, Bell decided, creative art, was shit. Beside him, Witt, who was apparently not bothered by any of these problems, raised himself to his knees and cautiously stuck his head up over the ledge. Bell went on with his thinking. Here there was no semblance of meaning, and the emotions were so many and so mixed up that they were indecipherable, could not be untangled. Nothing had been decided. Nobody had learned anything. But most important of all, nothing had ended. Even if they had captured this whole ridge, nothing would have ended, because tomorrow or the day after that, they would be called upon to do the same thing again, maybe under even worse circumstances. The concept was so overpowering, so numbing, that it shook Bell. Island after island, hill after hill, beachhead after beachhead, year after year, it staggered him. Okay, that's the end of the quote from the novel. I could go on longer because there's more very relevant in this monologue, but I'll just try to summarize that the same character, Bell, then goes on to reflect also on the relation of this unendingness to numbers and to the modern state and the irrelevance of individual experience in life to the outcome of the war. And I will quote just a little bit more. It would certainly end sometime, sure, and almost certainly because of industrial production and in victory. But that point in time had no connection with any individual man engaged now. Some men would survive, but no one individual man could survive. It was a discrepancy in methods of counting. Unquote. I'll stop reading from the monologue. Let us now go back to the film. Considered as a film d'auteur, we can note that Malick's version of The Thin Red Line deploys intermittent character voiceover, which are reminiscent of the voiceover narration by characters in his early films. But they function differently, such as Days of Heaven. But they function differently here as interior monologue like the novel rather than as recollecting narration as in the earlier films. It is true that some of the interior monologues in the film draw on those in the novel, but some are original, especially Witt's reflections on life, death, and love, which become privileged. The John Bell monologue I just cited is not included in the film. In fact, I think it's fair to say that Malick's The Thin Red Line is not a film that believes creative art is shit. On the contrary, it seeks to represent war with skillful mobilization of state-of-the-art Hollywood Steadicam shooting, bodily special effects, multi-channel sound mixing, the pyrotechnics that are now so conventional, contemporary Hollywood action and war films, and so forth. But all of this is in combination with Malick's trademark reflective philosophical voices over. That is, we get high-impact action cinema right alongside marks of the auteur as artist, with artistic seriousness signified partly by the voice-over interior monologues. Now, artistic and philosophical seriousness is also manifested in certain disjunctive shots throughout the film, which can unexpectedly interrupt lines of action. When Malick briefly cuts away from battles and narrative events or violence to seemingly unrelated shots of the island's beautiful but uncaring nature, foliage, wild parrots, and so forth. When you see this film, claims to both high impact realism and art are in the air, or to put it differently, there are elements of conventional realism combined with reflections on life and death and existence, along with indications of some sort of uncaring sublimity. I think what I'll do actually is I'll just show a very brief clip, just as a little taste of this. In the film, there are several moments where there's sudden cutaways to irrelevant animals in the trees and other kind in the middle of battle and so forth that kind of have no, that are just kind of observing impersonally what these humans are doing or not observing. I'll just give you a little taste of kind of how this is used in other parts of the film, these cutaways, by looking at the death of one of the main characters who in the film is Witt. This is not the clip I have on. Let's see. This is Witt's death. He's surrounded by Japanese.
これは、お前を殺したくない。わかるか。これは、お前を殺したくない。もう囲まれてるぞ。砂に降伏しろ。 俺の戦友殺したの。俺は動くな。
and back to the resumption of the plot. And this is what I mean, indications of some sort of uncaring sublimity, except it's more obvious in the battle scenes where there's these cutaways to an owl or a snake or something like this. That just doesn't seem relevant. Let us go back to the novel where Bell's monologue expresses the suspicion of conventional and artistic representations of violence. Note that this suspicion extends to narrative itself and is somehow tied to his skepticism about the relation of individual to the state. Bell's thoughts about unendingness call the possibility of narrative meaning into question, because a fundamental component of narrative enchainment is that every event has a reference to an ending, or at least to a later consequence. Somehow, Bell believes, even to conceive of an ending, and hence narrative enchainment, is to betray the actual experience of war violence. This suggests the following. For a representation of war violence to be pure and just, it would have to be something without a before and after. If we stick with Ricoeur's schema, this would necessitate withdrawal from calendrical and historical and narrative temporality itself in favor of the instant. It would require the temporality of the punctual. In that case, a truly just and purely adequate representation of war violence would be punctual violence. Throughout film history, in many conventional and also unconventional narrative films, represented violence does appear as the sudden blow, the sudden gunshot, the sudden explosion, or violence may appear as a sudden effect of unseen causes, the punch from off screen, the unexpected explosion, the gunshot from elsewhere, and so forth. Okay? In fact, in the Thin Red Line, the cutaways emphasize a contrast between calm continuity and the violent action that heightens the southernness. And in Witt's Death, which we just saw, I think it's a good example in the sense that we do not see the Japanese soldier pulling the trigger. We suddenly cut to a very different angle on Witt, and we see the impact with the blood squib, the state-of-the-art Hollywood special effects, the blood squib as the bullet hits the body and he goes down. And that comes even within this long buildup. It happens suddenly with the cause, you know, not quite seen, though we know what it is. And then we suddenly cut to this other narratively strange moments. Okay. Such moments, that is, moments of the sudden, raise the possibility that the temporality of violence can become that of the absolute surprise, the radical instantaneity that interrupts the normal or expected flow in a way that extracts the action from the story logic and makes it a unique instant. But this is only a potential. For surprise or not, the sudden is usually comprehended as fulfillment or initiation of a line of action or story, or in Malick, a philosophical indicator. In that case, its punctuality is vitiated, for it becomes subject to the causal logic of narrative action and the enchainment of actions and a component of meaning. That is, it entails a before and after. It would seem then that if there were such a thing as punctual violence, it would have to stand out from story logic and interrupt the temporal directionality which constructs a continuity of actions moving towards an ending. This is no easy thing, given that temporal directionality is also often taken as a technological characteristic of cinema itself. On the other hand, the affective impact of radical surprise and punctual violence would still require a basis in the protocols of narration and narrative meaning. These would serve as a discursive context for the representation of violence. This is because the surprise would have to involve the sudden departure from these, that is, the interruption of narrative enchainment associated with cinematic forward flow. The sudden is necessarily the interruption of directional flow. It seems that surpassing the calendrical time of narrative would require beginning from the calendrical time of narrative, so that there is something to interrupt against. So, punctuality requires interruption. And if its motivation is doing justice to violence, the issue then becomes the relation of the depiction of violence to interruption, but more crucially, the status of interruption in relation to narrative. If we think about the status in the film of The Thin Red Line, my view is that the film aestheticizes its disruptions. Again, my idea is that Malick does not agree with John Bell that creative art is shit. On the contrary. So in The Thin Red Line, my view is that the film aestheticizes its disruptions. This aestheticization is epitomized in the cutaways I've already mentioned to uncaring but beautiful nature. While the film may be grasping at an inarticulable sublimity with some of these, I also think its interruptions of narrative eventness are grossly overdetermined with ideological meanings connected to the aura of the primal or the primitive. They seem linked to the character Witt's association with the non-white Melanesian villagers as part of the uncaring, even incomprehensible natural. And we've seen examples of that in the scene just now. These Melanesians are neither in the novel, these images of Melanesians are neither in the novel, nor are they explained narratively in the film. Yet the film begins with Witt's barely explained idyll with Melanesians that appear at his moments of death, with blithe indifference to the events of the war itself. And here, then, I think this becomes an illustration of Jameson's warnings that appeals to violence gravitate towards ideology and metaphysics. What would more radical interruptions dealing with state violence be? Okay. One of the most interruptive filmic depictions of war I know is in the Marx Brothers film Duck Soup. But of course, it's subsumed generically as comic farce, which invites us to take its representations of violence less seriously, with surprise converted into the bodily affect of laughter. And I think at this point now, I will show you a couple of other clips from very different kinds of films. And I'm trying to make lists of these. If you think of others, you can come up to me and suggest films. But I will just show two clips. One is from Godard's Les Carabiniers, which was an attempt to make do the impossible, which was to make an anti-war film. And then the other is from a Palestinian film by Elias Sulaim and Divine Violence, a much more recent film. The Sulaim film was the one that first inspired me to think about this notion of punctual violence, to try to deal with it. So I'll show that first. In Divine Violence, in the first 30 minutes, about an hour and a half film, in the first 30 minutes, it's just a depiction of Palestinians living in Israeli-controlled area in the town, in Nazareth, which is an Arab town, even though it's within Israel. It's where Sulaiman comes from. And then a new character, played by Sulaiman himself, enters the film about one-third of the way through. We find out, almost nothing happens in the first 30 minutes. Narratively, virtually nothing. And then the new character enters, played by Sulaiman himself. We find out later that he's returning home because in the scene we're about to see, which we don't really know what's happening, his father's having a heart attack, okay? So we begin with the last moments of those first 30 minutes where nothing happens narratively, and you're not even quite sure why you're seeing what you're seeing. No, that's violence. Yes. That's okay. Okay, and now the scene, I could have chosen many scenes from Les Carabiniers. I chose one, which is a film that's full of filmic references. And there's one, some of you or all of you may know the film. It's a relatively early Godard film. And there's a war that two really stupid characters, male characters, go off on, and it becomes a kind of an odyssey, but a very strange one. And their names are Michelangelo and Ulysses. And at one point, one of them is in a movie theater in the middle of the war, goes into a movie theater. And what happens in this movie theater is that, as he's watching the film, is that a number of moments of early cinema, very early cinema, are reenacted. There's a reenactment of a train, the Lumiere's a train arriving at a station, and a reenactment, which kind of goes bad, of Baby's Breakfast, of Lumiere. And then a literalization of an early American film called, but it came up, and the same thing happened in some other cinemas, Uncle Josh at the Moving Picture Show, where a character from the countryside is so unsophisticated that he tries to rescue a woman in danger on the screen and tears down the movie screen, okay? And so these become kind of reenacted in this. And this is the end of the, we've already had train arriving at a station, we're coming in and the sort of the Baby's Breakfast, the Lumiere reference.
À la recherche des deux mystérieux visiteurs. Mais dites-moi, Superboy, quel intérêt portez-vous à ces hommes? Comme vous, Steve, je pense qu'il s'agit d'être...
That's our hero.
Alors, tu la manges, ta tarte, oui?
Non.
Allez, pouf, mais pouf, nom de Dieu!
Non.
Espèce de putain d'enfant de fasciste, alors tu la bouffes, t'es comme quoi tes merdes!
Needless to say, this does not happen in Lumiere. This film within the film is also a reenactment of another pre-classical film.
They are
postcards back to their two girlfriends from the battle.
Papa, il savait ça, tra-la-la. Il me casserait les doigts, tra-la-la.
Opa, camarade, opa, camarade, opa, opa, opa.
Okay. Okay, so I began, I was saying, you know, what would more radical interruptions dealing with state violence be than is evident in at least my reading of the Malick? And I said we might consider something like Godard's Les Carabiniers and these cutaways to documentary shots of actual wartime casualties in the middle of this kind of picaresque, cinematic picaresque kind of epic with all of these film references in the middle, and then the sudden cutaways to shots of actual wartime documentaries or newsreel of actual corpses and actual destruction, okay? So there's changes in the filmic registers here. And such cutaways, these cutaways to documentary shots of actual wartime casualties may surprise by suddenly interrupting these emblematically amoral adventures of the simple-minded soldiers Michelangelo and Ulysses, right? And in a film that thematizes cinematic representation and hence the very problem of representing war in film. And then I gave you another possible example from Elias Sulaiman's Divine Intervention, and this inexplicable cut to a tank exploding, something completely unexpected, I think, and never referred to again in the film. And the whole status of it is very odd. And of course, to be able to destroy Israeli tanks with a peach pit would certainly be the desire of outgunned and occupied Palestinians. So these are just a couple of scattered examples. I also mentioned the Marx Brothers, which is meant to be received in a comic register. A much longer and more systematic list would have to be made and interrogated, but already we may note that such moments may have something about them, which, for lack of a better term, we might call surrealistic or existing on a kind of a border between the surrealistic and the comic. This is not because they are dreamlike, my employment of the term surrealistic is not because they are dreamlike, but because they are concrete and solid representations on the one hand, yet they come to us as a logic from elsewhere than the normal everyday logic of narrative, of history, of the enchainments of before and after, intricated with calendrical time. That calendrical time which forbids the absolute instant. It would be necessary, then, for the punctual to come from elsewhere. In summary, an occurrence of punctual violence in narrative film would connect violence to an instantaneity. It is marked by the opposition of continuous succession and narrative versus interruption and instant. To tell the truth, I have come to suspect that if such a notion has any use, It is as a kind of vanishing point or limit category or an asymptotic concept rather than a category of realized film practices and discourses which can be found systematically instantiated in any kind of a pure form. But it is a vanishing point that marks a certain desire. This is a desire to do justice to violence. And now I come to my third and concluding section, which is called Enter the State. That's a question. That's a question mark with a question mark. There is a modest play on words in my phrase, doing justice to violence. On the one hand, it is a figure for a representational desire for adequation, as in the French phrase, mot juste, mot juste. On the other hand, the word justice has a long history and is filled with meanings of equity and fairness, but also of state-mandated legal procedures. I said at the beginning of this paper that my comments on punctual violence are an offshoot of my trying to think about state violence in cinema. How could state violence be related to punctual violence? This can be addressed through a certain line of much-cited theories of the state, which also involve temporal relations of continuity and interruption, but in relation to the law and violence. Excuse me. In a 1918 lecture, with anti-state rebellions occurring outside his lecture hall, Max Weber located the major characteristic of the state in relations of law and physical violence. He declared that the modern state is that type of, quote, human community that successfully claims the monopoly of the legitimated use of physical force within a given territory, unquote. This is perhaps the most famous definition of the modern state ever penned. An important line of modern political theory extends from this definition right to the present, where it has been central to many recent debates. For example, one widely influential example is Giorgio Agamben, but there are also several others. Agamben and Samuel Weber emphasized an implicit debate early in this line of political theory between Carl Schmitt and Walter Benjamin. Both Schmitt and Benjamin produced landmark formulations about state and violence within a few years of Weber's lecture. Schmitt famously proposes that the legality of sovereign power is paradoxically proven only by its capacity to suspend the very law legitimating it. The law becomes suspended in order to preserve the law, and by implication, the state. This is the much-noted state of exception. As with all politics, according to Max Weber, it always raises the possibility of employing violence in support of legitimation. This was in Schmitt's book, Political Theology. This was first proposed. But this is unlawful violence employed in the service of maintaining the law and the legitimated state. Schmitt likened this to the miraculous in theology, since the law is guaranteed only by a singular sovereign decision to act from a logic from elsewhere, from outside the law, a decision which is therefore unforeseeable within a system of legal norms. The norm requires the exception as a condition of its existence. In opposition, Walter Benjamin's critique of violence imagined a different deployment of force from outside the state and law. For Benjamin, the search was for violence that does not support law in the state, but justice, which for him was something different. While he referred to Georges Sorel's general strike as an example, he also referred to Greek myth and the Jewish Bible for examples. He called this kind of intervention divine violence and concluded that it could also be called sovereign violence, which seems a direct reference to Schmitt. Of course, the turmoil of post-World War I revolutionary movements was very fresh when Schmitt and Benjamin produced their formulations. Thus, we may treat both Schmitt and Benjamin as taking opposed stances on revolutionary or popular violence. But here, what I want to explore is a parallel with filmic punctual violence. In both Schmitt and Benjamin, the relation of violence to the law is figured as miraculous intervention and as revelation of a force beneath or superior to legal norms. Here, the modern state must secretly assume the possibility of radical interruption of its own normal operations, the normal operations of law and state. This interruption is figured as exception by one philosopher and divine violence by the other, but in either case, it partakes of a temporality reminiscent of the punctual. Both Benjamin and Schmitt see the revelation, the underpinnings of the state, the revelation of the underpinnings of the state in an unforeseeable, instantaneous, sudden present, radically detached from a before and after. And since they both envision this fundamental instantaneity as violence, it is possible to imagine a strange analogy between issues of cinematic representation and such theories of the state. Four, could I not argue that the filmic examples I showed you are exceptions, revelations of something underlying the violence being depicted, yet elsewhere to it, discontinuous with the world of the film. In that case, we may return to the fact that throughout cinema history, so much of narrative cinema constructs representations of state violence and ask about the modes of such representations. My filmic examples may be read as registering a desire to do justice to violence, but to do so within cinema. Hence, this desire mandates interruptions of the norms of cinematic representation, figuratively the laws of normal filmmaking, but for ethical, or to my view, better political motivations. Cinema itself, in both cases, its technological base and the history of its mainstream narrative practices, is also implicated not only in what Ricœur would see as directionality of calendrical time, but in addition in the dialectic of continuity and interruption. This is most obviously manifest in editing, and many of my examples had to do with editing today. But I would emphasize that despite my examples, it is not limited to editing. Contemporary film theorists such as Marianne Doane and Tom Gunning have given us new kinds of approaches and ways to emphasize continuous motion and disjunction, flow, and interruption. But already in 1922, Jiga Vertov could say, everything in cinema depends on the interval, such that cinema becomes, in this conception, the organization of blanknesses between shots and even between frames. At any rate, the strange, perhaps overly broad parallel on the level of temporality between political theory dealing with state and violence and filmic textuality engaging with state violence takes us to fundamental claims not just about the state and violence, but about cinema. It makes me wonder if figurations of the state and attitudes towards it might be found in the interval, as Vertov intuited. That would be a temporal framework characteristic of cinema itself, but as it is organized and elaborated through sequentiation and narrative. Flow is constructed on the substrate of an underlying interval, which can be deployed or foregrounded as a gesture toward itself, but never quite fully there. Again, we seem to be in the realm of something much like desire. But that said, I would add a postscript now, and this is my concluding postscript, so just stay with me, we're almost there. Recall again Jameson's warning that violence as an in itself, as a pure category, is always implicated in ideology rather than history. One might say the same for the representational desire to do justice to violence, a goal that probably can never be attained except, at least in my examples, for an instant. But perhaps on a theoretical level, there is an impossibility for any concept that yokes together justice and violence. Perhaps just violence is the limit concept. We should remember that for Benjamin, his only examples were of the divine and the mythic. Nevertheless, it is inescapable that yoking together issues of justice and violence has a long genealogy in narrative cinema. Just within mainstream film, it extends from the classical Western to the contemporary big-budget action film to the Asian martial arts and Hong Kong action films. And these are only the most obvious generic examples in global cinema, because this question has affected various strands of art cinema, festival cinema, avant-garde cinema, and so forth. Finally, however, it is necessary to historicize the device, which I have suggested are central means for engaging with the desires of punctual violence. It is now becoming a commonplace among film historians, theorists, and critics to suggest that our current period of global narrative filmmaking is a period that conventionalizes heavy fragmentation through editing to an historically unprecedented degree. This conventionalization of fragmentation is historically unprecedented. The socioeconomic epitome of this development is the action film, is the mainstream action film, which highlights spectacular violence and which may contain over 2,000 shots in a single feature film. I have a note here, clip from a Bourne film, if there is time. There is not time. Thus, for example, it is now well within mainstream norms to employ formerly avant-garde or art cinema technique of jump cuts, that is to activate the interval repeatedly and with rapidity unprecedented outside, historically outside, the avant-garde tradition. But if the empty instant seems to flash up, it is surely narratively recuperated in the service of conventional ideologies that always provide a goal for the violence. It may be ideologically overdetermined, for example, by gender roles, masculinity and violence. Perhaps this integration of fragmentation into mainstream ideologies is one factor of the interest within global art cinema of so-called slow filmmaking as a kind of protest. But in terms of my concerns here, I would emphasize that these kind of extreme fragmentation of the mainstream may well operate to control and tame the interval. It becomes exactly what novelistic character John Bell detested. And it is one of those things that may be proven. It becomes neither exception nor divine violence. And these are one of the things that may be proven when a filmic fight ends, whether the fight is against the state of agency, the state as agency of legitimated violence, or for it. Nevertheless, it becomes neither exception nor divine violence. Jameson himself has proposed one answer. Using a Hollywood action film as an example, he proposed that this normalization of the interruption is a drive for a kind of end to temporality itself, for it seeks precisely pure immediacy without a before and after. For Jameson, this is the epitome of all ideology, since it obstructs historicization by universalizing a phenomenological immediacy. I'd say that which some contemporary film theorists some contemporary film theorists conceive as affect. It seeks a pure, unmediated presence as the present without a past and future. But it does so precisely through mediation, inevitably, that is, media. Once again, we are in the realm of something like the punctual. We may want to dismiss the desire for the punctual as sheer self-delusion. But what about the desire to do justice to violence? What about the yearning for violence that would be only be in the name of justice? This seems to me to be not just reducible to ideology, but it is an ideological field subject to intervention, contradiction, struggle, whether through the punctual and other means. And the cinematic has always engaged with it as cinema. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your brilliant and dense paper, which gives us a huge number of political issues, not only about cinema, of course, but between the relationship between cinema and politics and social life and society and so on. Anyway, I have a lot of ideas and questions that I would like discuss with you, but do you have questions for Phil? I would like to give them the chance to to start with you. Please, Tony. Mm-hmm. Can you hear him?
No.
I was just saying, repeating Giacomo's thanks for the really interesting and thought-provoking paper. I'm going to ask actually quite a simple question, but I'm going to do a really, hopefully not too boring introduction to it, because I've worked quite a lot on, I've thought quite a lot about violence in cinema. I've worked quite a lot on the representation of the mafia in Italian cinema.
Could you put the mic a little closer?
Sorry.
Thank you.
I was saying I've worked quite a lot on the representation of mafia in Italian cinema, so that obviously has a lot of violence in those kinds of films that tend to be, I'm really interested by this question of what of doing justice to violence, because I think that there's some interesting examples in mafia films in Italy in particular, but not only, where I was thinking about it during your paper, because I'm not entirely sure if it's punctual violence or if it's a different kind of alternate timed violence, because it tends to be a lot more direct. You tend to see the violence much more directly. We don't have these kinds of narrative pauses necessarily. But it's kind of inverted in the sense that we see a lot of violence against not the mafia, but like good people, people who stand up to the violence, who are then massacred by the mafia in order to make a point and make the audience sort of, in an ironic way, I don't know if you can say take pleasure, or maybe the opposite of taking pleasure in it, because you then come out of the film thinking, I'm against the mafia because I've suffered, because I've watched this good person being killed by the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of displacement of violence, which actually I think you can see in international cinema too, like in the case of something like 12 Years a Slave, where the kind of violence that we see on black bodies in that film, which again, I don't think it's punctual violence exactly, because it's much more direct. We don't have those kinds of anti-narrative pauses in the same way. But I think it's an interesting instance too, because it's a kind of parenthesized displacement. It's not necessarily, maybe it's the opposite of punctual, because it's kind of badly timed violence, because it's sort of does justice to the political message of the film by ironizing on the violence. That thought process then, this is the really simple question, I guess, is given that I'm those kinds of violence that I've been thinking about are in very specific instances of films, so films about slavery or films about the mafia, my question was really in the other examples, or these examples that you found about punctual violence, whether there is any kind of continuity in the kinds of films, whether there's a generic aspect to it, or whether there's necessarily not a generic aspect to punctual violence.
The film the film you mentioned was 12 Years a Slave. That was I think there's I think that's a kind of a film. I'll take 12 Years a Slave, the Italian films, you would know better than I would, I think. But I'll take 12 Years a Slave. And I would say that I think 12 Years a Slave is the kind of very sincere film that wants to get something across that is the opposite. On at least two levels of punctual violence. Okay. One level is that it's clearly emplaced within a very, very developmental narrative, which includes not only the events of the film, but the fact that it's about American slavery. You know, 120 years ago, whenever it was set, 150 years ago. And that there's something in historical representation that always comes from the present. That is, it wants to be relevant in some way, you know, so history is made useful. Precisely by focusing on the overt presence of enacted violence, which is always necessarily a special effect. It's why it can't be pure violence. It's always enacted, okay? The thing about punctual violence is that it's coming from some place where it cannot be enacted, and we have the divine violence, the Sulayman foregrounds the fact that this is an impossibility, It's sudden, but then on top of that, you know, what is this? A peach pit blowing up a tank. You know, this is where it sort of tilts into a kind of surrealism, because there is photographed an actual tank blowing up. In fact, he was forbidden to film this in Israel. He had to go to France to make that one scene. For that one scene, he had to film. All the rest was filmed in Israel, but that he had to film in France. The authorities wouldn't let him film a peach pit blowing up an Israeli tank. You know, it comes from elsewhere in all sorts of ways, you know. But in terms of something like A 12-Year Slave, where you see the blood coming out of the body, you see the whip hitting the body, and so on and so forth, that's always an enactment. That's where you come out satisfied. You feel the emotion. You're supposed to. It's this presence of an immediacy rather than something that comes from elsewhere, and hence it has meaning now in the present, you know. And so what I was trying to get at with a notion of pure or just violence or doing justice to violence was the fact that we can't go out and say that we know, yes, slaves were treated like that, but we did not see an actual black body being whipped. Our bodies were not actually whipped, you know. And Godard does this in the opposite direction by having a completely loopy, loony kind of unspectacular mise-en-scene of war and loopy, loony characters. And with these scenes like, and constant references to the fact that you're watching a movie or what a film is, and then these sudden cutaways to corpses and the actual, which you can recognize as wartime footage. So you go to something which has a different kind of indexical register, which is not reenactment. You have to look at a corpse, and it comes at you suddenly. You can't turn your eyes away if you don't like looking at corpses. It comes at you too suddenly, you know. And so I think this distinction, you know, this question of what you do about the fact that when you're making a fiction film, you have to reenact violence. So it's always fictional, and that's why, in a certain, maybe that explains why that you sort of, one of the things that has to happen is that the sort of the fabric of the fictional world maybe has to tear open a little bit for an instant, okay? So in order to get at what the film is getting at, I mean that's what I'm thinking. But I think that's a kind of film that which is not the kind of thing that I talked about the sort of the action film and so forth. But it's a very serious attempt to make a historical film that matters now. But that fits in the whole chain of narrative cause and effects. And I think it doesn't. In some way, I guess I do believe it's not quite as, I'm not against it, I just don't believe it's quite as radical. It doesn't challenge the spectator as much, you know. And it comes into the sort of, it's supposed to come into the phenomenological presence of the spectator and make us flinch and so forth, right? Yeah. But then we can leave kind of secure in the fact that this was not really a black body being torn up by the whip. Yeah. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other question? Giorgio.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't know if it is also your point. Maybe it's just an aberrant reading I'm doing of your lecture. But do you think that punctual violence can be seen as, can be read self-reflexively as a way in which cinema discloses the violence of the cinematic apparatus? I mean, you know, you're sensitive to this kind of questions. I mean, continuity is a form of violence of the apparatus. Mm-hmm. And punctual violence, I think, disrupts continuity. So it disrupts a form of violence. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes. I think that's a very interesting way to think about it. I guess in retrospect, I might have said, I think that's a very sharp question. I think that's a good question. My answer to it is to sort of say, look at how the terms are inverted in filmic conventions. it's the unexpected cut that seems to be the violence towards our expectations, right? And you're suggesting that because the filmic apparatus is actually, in actuality, runs by still frames in the conventional filmic apparatus, that the actual violence is imposing continuity, right? Yeah, and I think that's an idea, and it may be in my own sort of education and subconscious. You know, it's an idea that goes straight back to post-1968 film theory, and maybe I'm unconsciously kind of, there's a residue of that in my head, because, of course, if you know, Baudry's ideological effects of the cinematographic apparatus, you know, his point is exactly that what the apparatus is doing, you know, that there's levels of illusion that have to be piled up in order to obscure what the apparatus is doing, in order to secure the subject, and that would be the kind of violence you're talking about, I think. And he discusses continuity and disjunction, so maybe I'm hearkening back to that. Maybe you're revealing that to me. Does that make sense? Is that yeah? I think that's a good question. Yeah.
I go with my first question because it's linked to the Georgios one. One of your examples, the Godard's one, reminded me another Nouvelle Vague movie, which is Adieu Philippine by Rosier. I think you know it. Where the only violent shot is the last one, which changes the meaning of the entire movie, because it's a comedy, a nice comedy located in Paris, in the emerging TV world, and everything changes at the end with this single shot where Rosier explains that the main character died during the Algerian War, after the story. So my question was about pictures, I mean photography. I was thinking also to a movie like Flags of Our Fathers by Clint Eastwood. Do you think that this concept of punctual violence could work also outside the cinematic apparatus in a media like photography, or absolutely not?
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting comparison there is, and there's a etymological comparison too, is the obvious comparison, I should say, it's not the only one, is to Barthes' concept of the punctum, right? In which he experiences photographs, certain photographs only, in ways that there's a certain detail or point that pulls him in and interrupts, you know, the normal public functions of photographs and does something. But I think it's very important in Barthes that this is a very interior, it's not a public thing. You remember that the key photograph that has the greatest, that makes for the greatest punctum, is the photograph of his mother, which he never shows you. It's the one photograph he discusses, he doesn't show you in that book. And he doesn't show you, he says, it's because it won't have that effect on you, it won't be a punctum for you. So that the punctum is not a public thing, you know, it's rather a withdrawal into a subjective fantasy. Not fantasy is the wrong word, but I don't know what I mean, but it's an imaginary experience, right? And this may have something to do with the fact that you're dealing with still images, right, rather than motion images, motion imaging, I think. And it's very striking to me. I mean, I've tried to think a little bit about this, and I've wondered. And Barr also says, you know, you won't have the punctum in cinema, right? So that kind of affect won't go there. And again, it has nothing to do with a public problem or a public issue like violence, right? So I'm not sure if you, maybe you have an idea about how you could get past that problem of the still versus the moving image, because I said it's a matter of temporality, but in terms of the photograph we learned from Bart, our ultimate temporality is interior, because our eyes are free to spend as much time as we want or as little time as we want on a given image, whereas not the case in film. So it seems to me to be quite different, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking my idea were those pictures, books like Salgado's or Dondero or even Capa's ones, this kind of experience of viewing many different pictures, images, single images which compose a narrative.
Yes.
And sometimes one of them keeps you, stands out, and that's the why I asked you this. Mm-hmm. And any other? Well, there are so many points that. Just another one is about this ambiguity between desire and violence. Probably also Dominic was referring to something like that in mafia movies, but I was thinking how we could include this ambiguity in the discourse about another kind of ambiguity, the use of violence by the state. I mean, do you think that, how can I say, people as an ambiguous relationship with the use of violence by the state? It reminded me an important political case, the so-called Diaz case. Diaz was the name of the place where the Italian police made a sort of a massacre of the activists in Genoa in 2000 or 2001. Yeah. And there's an Italian director who made a movie, Daniele Vicari, I think is the director of this movie, and it's very impressive because the entire movie is based on the representation of violence of the police. But at the same time, at a certain point, I was wondering what could happen to different audiences watching an hour and a half of this violence. Disgusting at the same time appealing. There was something appealing. So I don't know if it happens the same with the, for instance, the TV images about violence, and also maybe, you know, the media representation of terrorism and so on. I don't know if it's clear or not. The relationship between desire and violence in the use of violence by the state and the public sphere, the media sphere.
Right. Well, the state always claims that, I don't know if I can speak to the particular case and film that you mentioned, but the state normally claims that its violence is justified. Right. Now, what is meant by that, and this is quite clear in Weber and the Walter Benjamin piece of Critique of Violence, very early Benjamin. It's quite clear that what is meant by that, and this is the legitimation of, this is fundamental to the legitimation of state violence, is a fit. A match between means and ends. that as state violence is normally legitimated and justified on the basis of this is the means necessary for this end, let's say the security of citizens against terrorism or something like that, right? Okay. And this is the basis for Schmitt's notion of state of exception. He says at a certain point when the state is so threatened, the sovereign may go against the law and suspend the law and deploy any kind of violence in order to save the law and the state. Okay, there's in American jurisprudence, there's an old cliche, the US Constitution is not a suicide pact. I mean, judges have quoted this over the years. Nobody knows where it came from, but judges have quoted this, you know. So if there's a threat to the Constitution, the implication is we will countenance suspending the Constitution. Abraham Lincoln did this during the Civil War in certain states. He suspended the Constitution to make sure they wouldn't leave the Union, you know. So, but at any rate, and most countries have a provision for that. In the U.S., it's not written down, but the courts have allowed it in some cases. So, but it's always a matter of means and ends, a fit between means and ends, okay? So what Benjamin tries to do with his notion of divine violence is to say, I'm not talking about a justified violence in terms of means and ends, okay? I'm talking about a violence that imposes justice and therefore is an end in itself, okay? And he goes to the Hebrew Bible and to Greek myth for a couple of cases in which he thinks this is figured. This is figured, okay? And so in terms of, you know, and that's what I say, punctual violence, I'm trying to imagine an extreme, you know? What would it be then to represent violence that is not a means towards a narrative end, that is not a means towards the end of showing the good or evil of the state violence, but, you know, violence in itself. And again, at some level, I don't think this could be done. And there's Jameson's warning that whenever you ask about violence in itself, you're teetering on the edge of sheer pure ideology. You're teetering towards metaphysics. And I mean, I'm very nervous, by the way, for those interested in contemporary film theory. I'm very nervous. This is a side. This is a parenthesis. I'm very nervous about the move towards conceptions of life as a fundamental theoretical category, of biological life as a fundamental theoretical category, affect, you know, the pure immediacy of movie watching. You know, maybe I'm just getting old, but I'm getting a little nervous about some of these new approaches, precisely on, you know, because of the kinds of, like somebody like Jameson says, which is that you're teetering on the edge of a kind of a metaphysics here. And if you want to do metaphysics, fine, let's do metaphysics, but let's not, you know, let's not say we're making a claim about filmic representation or something like that, or the effects of films on audience. We're talking about metaphysics. But at any rate, so back to your question. So the search for an outside that underpins the norm, you know, and letting it flare up, okay, seems to me very difficult. And when you talk about the actuality of state violence, you know, it seems to me that this happens sometimes among, let's say, radical pacifist groups, right? And perhaps, I'm not sure, I don't know enough, perhaps among some anarchist groups, perhaps, I'm not quite sure. And I would have to think about it. I actually haven't thought much, because for me it's such a matter of temporality, and I've been thinking about it so much through film, you know, I think, I think the desire might be in a lot of radical politics, actually. Okay. But I think the notion of the punctual itself, you know, I want to be pretty careful to limit to film and media. And I think, and another parenthesis, you mentioned television. And at the end of my paper, I dealt with a problem that's pretty difficult for my conception, which is in the last 30 years, fragmentation has become such a norm of mainstream film that one has to now differentiate histories of fragmentation. One can no longer assume it's disruptive. And television has been fundamental to that shift. I mean, there's post-Peckinpah action film and Hong Kong film on the one hand, and historically I'm talking, and then there's television, in which is sold in 15 and 30 second blocks to advertisers. And there's television stylistics, which just also permeate media culture. And both of those things have made fragmentation such a norm that now one has to make very fine distinctions among kinds of fragmentation in a way one maybe wouldn't have had to do in the 1920s avant-garde, you know, Soviet montage or something, yeah. I think I've been kind of wandering around your question, the different aspects of it. I'm not sure I've fully, you know, addressed it.
Thank you very
much. Yeah.
And, don't be shy if you have a question for Professor Rosen, or I'll take advantage of your being here. And I have a last question about if and to what extent we could apply this notion of punctual violence to the symbolic violence. I mean, you talked about the physical representation, the representation of physical violence direct, but if we could find something similar in the representation of symbolic violence, for instance, racism, sexism, and so on, mm-hmm. in movies.
In movies, okay. Yeah. I was going to say that in life, in real life, you know, those things always lead to, those things are always grounded in violence, okay? And so, to the extent one of the assumptions in my paper, I mean, I've refused to give up the term ideology. You know, that's another aspect of being old. I refuse to give up the term ideology. So I think that sort of, you know, this, what you describe as symbolic violence is always, kind of ideologically related to the potential for the actuality of violence. And again, one of the questions is the way the films handle it. You know, you have these controversies like about, if you take some classical Hollywood genre films, like you take The Searchers, right? Which seems to be all about the torment of one man and the violence against his family, but really, and seems to have some racist discourses running through it about the Native Americans, but you know, really.
One of the worst sequences when John Wayne kicks the Native American
Absolutely.
Woman. Which is awful. Yep.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, the film very clearly portrays the heroic John Wayne as a racist and as somebody who wants to kill, you know. And the racism is linked to the want to kill, and it's tied up with repressed sexuality and desire. It's extraordinary, and it's all gotten in without ever getting into words. Because the film itself is constructed in such a way that its own signifying practices kind of run by repression, so that his unfulfilled love for his sister-in-law who's killed can never be spoken in the film, and yet that's a motivation for his racism. You know, it's tied up his sexual desire and his sort of remarks about miscegenation, But anyway, but I think so I think, but there are other Westerns of the same period, which are just very clearly there's racist. You can't find the contradictions, and the racist discourse is right there, and it's just fine with very ordinary conventional depictions of killing Indians and imperialism and all the rest of that, and it's just fine with it. So I think in terms of what you're calling symbolic violence and these kinds of ideologies, I think there are histories of these things, and one has to make differentiations, and this is why, you know, close readings still matter when you construct histories of filmic representation, I think. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Phil. And, well, if you don't have any other question, I just have to thank you so much for your kindness, for being here with us, and I hope to have you again next year if you'll come back. Absolutely. To the festival, and we will have the chance to meet during the screenings and in these days. So thank you very much again for your speech.